Okay, welcome everybody. Erev Tov. I kind of want to thank the Sosson family for sponsoring this series in memory of their father, Albert Sosson, Avram Ben Sala, by Jacob and Joseph. Thank you. And okay, we're looking forward. This is class number 6, I believe, in our ongoing series of Rav Gorin. And let's get right to it. Thank you very much, everybody.
Well, let me first thank all of those who came out yesterday. I spoke on my book on Rav Kook, including our sponsor, or one of our sponsors, Jacob, was there. Huge crowd, I think, for such an event at Mizrahi Books. If you haven't been to Mizrahi Books, next time you're in Brooklyn, you should check it out. It is unique. 500,000 books in one giant place. There is no place like this in the world, including in Israel. And the gathering was also like you won't see anywhere else. Everyone, we had the Hasidim and the Modern Orthodox and the others. And so I thank Mizrahi Books and also Kingsway Jewish Center for sponsoring that. And for those of us, for those who are listening to us from England, Mirz Hashem, this Saturday night in London at the Neri Yisrael Show, I'll be giving the same talk. The jokes might be different, but the talk is the same. So see you there. Okay, let's get right to it. A couple of things, as is our wont. You know, we're going to start, one of the issues we're going to be dealing with as we go forward is, and we already saw Rav Gorin made the claim, well, you know, you're not a Dayan. So you might be a big rabbi, but you're not a Dayan. And I've, over the years, I've given judgments. I've said that, and we all do, that this rabbi is greater than that rabbi. One time, someone asked me, well, how can you make such a judgment? And really, you're right. How can you? But I mean, I think we can say that Moshe Feinstein is greater than some person. I don't need to mention a name here. And everyone does that in the yeshiva world. Sometimes there'll be disputes, like people in Jerusalem used to say, or Tziuda says it, Tziuda Cook and others, that Ritzi Pesach Frank was greater, Sakra Avadya says it, than the Chazon Ish. But obviously the people in Bnei Brak say the Chazon Ish. But for those who are interested in this, just I just happened to run across it the other day, so I figured I'd mention it to you. In the Sadeh Chemed, if you look in Mareches Shin, Kol Peivav, he says, "Ein isur lomar rav poni gadol b'torah miponi ve'ein bazeh shum zilzul kavod l'asheni." He goes on and says it's not a zilzul to say about one rabbi is greater than another. He quotes the Rivash that says Rabbeinu Tam is greater than Rabbeinu Hananel and Rashi. And the point is that this is an old thing and you can dispute. You might be wrong in what you're saying, but it's not a lack of respect to say that a certain rabbi, in your opinion, is greater than others. You might not know enough to have an opinion, but it's not a disrespect. Last class, we spoke about the issue of corporations. And I thank Moshe from Lakewood. He called my attention to an Igros Moshe, which I didn't recall. That's Yoredeya, volume 2, number 39, two paragraphs, addressed to, in 1961, to Rav Yisrael Schwarzblatt. Now, he doesn't tell us who Rav Yisrael Schwarzblatt is here. At the time, he was a rabbi in Odessa, a Slabodka graduate. But as Moshe points out, and thank you very much, unfortunately, later, this rabbi... So he was supposed to be made chief rabbi in Moscow, but rabbis from Russia who had made their way to Israel said that he was actually a KGB agent. And so Rav Moshe here has a tshuva to a KGB agent, a rabbi KGB agent. Of course, there were other rabbis who were worked for. We know that in Czechoslovakia, I remember, they found out that the so-called head rabbi was reporting. I don't know what the line is between being an agent and just trying to create good relations, but apparently this guy went overboard. But he had an interesting question. If let's say the kelim in the Medina, this wasn't really the case in Russia, but if let's say you have certain kelim that belong to the Medina, namely Russia, well, actually not the kelim, the factory belongs to Russia. And they make the utensils. Do you need to do tefillah then? Because it's not a corporation where we saw Rav Moshe said, well, if the majority are non-Jews or the ones who are important, I should say, are non-Jews. This is just a country. So it's interesting. Rav Moshe says he thinks that perhaps Efshar Shelo Bli Tefillah. He says that it could be you don't need Tefillah. But in the end, he says that he says it's best to do Tefillah because the majority of the Medina are of the country are non-Jews. But it, you know, it's interesting. Like take a let's say the American Cancer Society decided to get us everyone together and do a charity thing and make utensils. Not hire a company to do it, but make it. I mean, is the American Cancer Society, that's not Jewish. That's not non-Jewish. It's its own independent entity. Yeshivas, by the way, these questions go back to yeshivas. Do you know that Rav Scheinberg holds or held? This is found in Rav Shurkin's Megat Givas Olam, Givos Olam. Page 167, that a yeshiva or a shul do not need to, or any mosad tzedakah, do not need to sell their chametz. Now, and it's actually not because it's not a person. He says that the Gemara says that, you know, not, if you have non-Jewish chametz, like you don't need to get rid of it if it doesn't belong to you. And it also says, Mamon Chametz Gavoa, if it belongs to, let's say, the Beis Hamikdash. So Rav Scheinberg says the whole thing, that, you know, it's not an entity. A yeshiva doesn't belong to anyone. And in this case, if it's a corporation, maybe you'd say, but Rav Scheinberg says not a yeshiva. Okay, I want to say a few words about the issue of Mamzerus before, even before we get in, we'll start today Rav Gorin's book and his argument, but there's still some things I want to mention about the response. We're going chronologically, so we see the response before we see Rav Gorin's argument. All we see is Rav Gorin's psak. But a couple important points about Mamzerus, because as we're going to be looking at Rav Gorin's argument, some of you might say, well, that's really bending over backwards. That's really relying on leniencies. But the truth is that's the Mesorah. That's the tradition. I'm going to show you a few things in the Shulchan Aruch now. But before that, I just want to tell you a story. I've never told this story. And after, it's interesting because this was a story which I had for us. And this event took place in my previous lifetime in a rabbinic role in 1993 or 92. And then I saw the Masoras Moshe, the same thing. I'm approached by someone who, about Tshuva, and he tells me this following story, that his mother was previously married, then she got divorced, and she's remarried, and he never spoke to his mother about this thing. He understands it's maybe uncomfortable, but he knows that she was married. And he just learned about this idea of Mamzerus. And now he's all concerned that his mother was married, and he's not from a religious family, so she certainly didn't get a get. So now he feels that he might be a mamzer because he's the product of the second marriage. So listen, in this role, I could answer basically all the questions, because what are the questions that come up? They, you know, how things in shul, Shabbos, and at the end of the day, you know, if I make a mistake, okay, so it's a mistake, it's here and done. But this is obviously a question of beyond my reach. So what did I do? I called Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt. Musmachov. Talmud Muvak of Rav Moshe Feinstein. More tshuvos are found in Iras Moshe to Rav Ephraim Greenblatt than any other rabbi. And Rabbi Greenblatt said to me, do not ask any, you know, because so the boy asks me, he says he knows it's difficult, but if he has to, he will ask his mother. And at the end of the day, normally we say about matters, Efshar Levarer, if you can ascertain it, like kashrus, right? If we have an issue there, we don't just, if we don't know, and sometimes we rely on the rove and things like that, but if you can get to the bottom of it, if you can ask the question, then you ask the question and you find out you know for certain. I say, here, you could ask. Rabbi Greenblatt told me, no. Tell him, do not ask a question. Just forget about it. And then Rabbi Greenblatt explained to me. He says, we can assume that the first marriage was not an Orthodox marriage. And if it's not an Orthodox marriage, then you don't need a get. Okay, what do you mean you can assume? Why should you assume? When you can determine. But the point is, you don't need to determine. And by the way, there are plenty of people in America, especially years ago, who even though they're not Orthodox, were married by an Orthodox rabbi. Either they're the non-observant Orthodox who belong to an Orthodox synagogue, or they grew up there and their parents belong to it. But Rabbi Greenblatt told me, you don't ask. And I believe, I am certain, the same, he would have given the same answer if the family was from, if the woman had grown up in Israel, because although most people get married halachically in Israel, who says she got married in Israel? Maybe she got married in Cyprus. Or maybe she got a get. In other words, you don't ask the questions. And for all the, I've no had this story in my mind, I've told people for all these years that this is Rabbi Greenblatt. And then Masoras Moshe, these are the traditions of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, which recorded his psukim, day in and day out. And if you look in volume 2, number 316, look what I'm going to read you. So it could be that Rabbi Greenblatt just absorbed this and all the, when he was with Rabbi Moshe, or it could be he was told this explicitly. It says, a bocher in a yeshiva came before Rabbeinu, that's Rabbi Moshe, and asked him about a relative of his who is not so religious and he's going to get married. And it's now come to his knowledge that the mother of the girl he's going to get married to was previously married, and it's unclear whether she got a divorce, a get. And the boy, the man, the bacher who's came to Ramosha says, he asked them, which he shouldn't have, but he asked them, are they certain that she got with her first marriage had a get? And they said they haven't investigated it. And he asked them, well, did the first marriage have a chuppah and kiddushin? And they said they don't know. And Rabbi Tendler says he is certain that it's usher to do a chakira and drisha and try to investigate this. But then he asked Rav Moshe, because at the end of the day, you know, you can find out it's a suffake. And Rav Moshe says that muta, it's permissible for the bachur to go to the wedding, because he wasn't sure if he'd go to the wedding, v'chadin mischatnim, because they're getting married properly. And what did Rav Moshe say? Rav Moshe agreed with, he says that it's ain't so, not only ain't sorach achor, usur achor. That is, we don't investigate. It's a strange thing. I don't know anywhere else where you have a situation like this where you don't investigate. And by the way, we don't use DNA for mamzerus. We'll use DNA to free an aguna, but won't use it the other direction, to determine mamzerus. Let me read you one more thing. And I thank Rabbi Eliezer Finkelman for sending this to me. He told this happened in 1977 from Rabbi Sheldon Steinberg. Some of you might remember him. He was a hospital chaplain in Toronto when he was invited to serve on the Boston Basin. And they were going to rule in a case of mamzerus. So he went to the Rav, and the Rav asked him who else is on the Basin. And it turns out one of the older East European rabbanim was on it. And the Rav said to him, pay careful attention to what the rabbi says and do the same. And you'll learn the authentic tradition from Europe. So on the Basin, they heard the facts of the case, which appeared to require them to rule that the person was a mamzer. But when they went to deliberate, the older rabbi asked, you know, let's discuss it. Try to tell me why you shouldn't be a mamzer. They offered a few theories, and eventually they came up with something, and the rabbi said, oh, we can rely on this. And we will not tell anyone how we reached that conclusion. In other words, we'll come out with a psak. This is our psak without explaining it. It's no one else's business. That's going to be part of the problem here. Rav Gorin has to justify it because people are challenging him. And then Rabbi Steinberg went to the Rav, and the Rav explained that now he knew the authentic tradition from Europe, and he knows how to deal with that in the future. And then Rabbi Finkelman says that a respected layman in the Detroit Jewish community, Manny Middleman, told me this. He survived the Shoah from Auschwitz, and he knew that a woman from the old country had married after the war, but her first husband, he knew the first husband's still alive. And she remarried. So first of all, he could make a stink, he could tell her, whatever. So he asked Rav Box, the big Rav in Rosh Hashiva in Detroit, what he should do with that information. And Rabox lifted a finger to his lips. That is, don't say a word. Now, let me show you the Shulchan Aruch. Because I don't know if all these really, they don't seem to be in line with the Psak of the, at least the Shulchan Aruch. But look what the, just to show you how far we go. The Shulchan Aruch says as follows. It talks about not mixing with Mamzerim. And what does the Rama say? This is in Evan Ezer 2. That's if you know it, but a mishpacha, a family that's been, that a pasul has mixed in it and is not known to people, kevan shidimad nitba. Since they're already mixed in, they're mixed in. Vahayodea psua eno rishay lagosa. You cannot reveal it. What do? Let me read the English here. Oh, it says, well, it says, Ella. You don't say anything. In the future, we know we have a tradition that in the future, Messianic days, everyone, all the families will be made kosher. And then he says, you can tell certain people, you know, don't marry that family because they mix with the mamzer, but you can't make it public. Why can't you make it public? Mamzers, because once it's been mixed, it's mixed. So there's a mila not to marry that. But there's no isser. So you can't say it publicly. You can, so the question is then what all these situations when you declare that kids and moms are you know, it could be a problem. But then look what he says, Vadafka Mishpacha Shinitma, Vinisarva. This only refers to when they're already mixed in, the moms are already married. But if they haven't, Kol Zman Shalom Nisarva Nagalin Hapsuli, Umachrizin Alayim. You do make it public if they're not married so that the people can separate from them. So that seems to go against the European tradition that we've heard so much in the stories I just told you, that even if they haven't married, if they're just about to get married, maybe I think some hold that if they're about to get married, that's considered as if they're nitma'a. I don't know. You really need a dayan to go through all these things because we do have plenty of examples where it seems that they're not in line with what he says, that if they're not already mixed in, you should let people know. But even the idea that when they're mixed in, what do you mean? So they're mixed in, so what? Don't we know that a child of a mamzer is a mamzer? So, and look at this, another halacha, Evan Ezer 4. Okay, listen to this to show you how far we bend over backwards. I'll just read the English. If a woman's husband traveled abroad and remained there for more than 12 months, and she had a child after 12 months, that child is a mamzer, says his. That child is a mamzer because gestation is never longer than 12 months. Okay, so what does Rama say? During 12 months, there's no concern because we could say it's a long gestation. So halakha l'maisa, Shulchan Aruch and the Rama, a woman gives birth at 11 and a half months, we still assume it's her husband's. Now, come on. We know it's not, but based on the Gemara, we can rely on this, and we don't override the Gemara with our scientific information. And then look at this; it goes even more. Let's say she gave birth with only 5 months. That is, her husband's away. Then he returns, and she gets pregnant. She gives birth 5 months later. We still say it's her husband's. And they were asked about, Rav Herzog actually thought that we should do not DNA testing, but blood testing to maybe, but everyone else said, no, we don't do this. We don't, it only goes one direction. Like today we use DNA testing to get the results. If we find, unfortunately, pieces of bodies like they did after 9/11 or unfortunately, maybe today even with the war, but it's good enough to free an aguna, but we're not going to go the other direction. So it just shows you the tradition of bending over backwards for these matters. Okay, let's pick up. Before we get into the actual book, and we will get into it, at least I hope we will, because I said I would. There's two more things I want to do. First is I told you about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Lubavitcher Rebbe comes out against Rav Gorin twice, as we saw. The first time was... we already saw beef when he's running for chief rabbi. And then when he's elected as chief rabbi. And then right when he's elected and he issues the psak. As soon as Rav Gorin issues the psak, what happens? The Lubavitcher Rebbe comes out with a public statement. Ha'admor Milobavich Korel Rav Gorin Litpater, that the Lubavitch Rebbe calls on Rav Gorin to resign. And there's two sichot that I'm aware of. Maybe there's more. The first is 1973, Tashem Lama Gimel, it's Yutes Kislev. And the Rebbe, it begins, this is, I'm reading from Torah Menachem. It begins on page 258, where the Rebbe, first of all, says, he says, in any posek dinim, the Rebbe says, I'm not a posek. So I'm not looking at the halachic issue. I'm just looking at the larger issues here. And he says that when you have someone who says, I want to become a Rav, in this case, chief rabbi, and if you want me to free them, then I'm going to, I'll take care of it for you. He says, that doesn't work in traditional Judaism, and that's a problem. And then he goes on to say, I read it backwards. If someone says, I want you to be mater, let's say this, the Langer children, and basically that's the masses think, who say that, or the politicians, that this has to be done, and that you can find a heter, that doesn't work. Only great rabbis can be involved with this. Then he goes on to say that there are always Jews who observed Tarya Mitzvos, and there were Jews who observed less mitzvos. But no one ever said in the past, they didn't say that you have to, you know, they didn't say that I'm observing, let's say, 612 mitzvos as a lechachila. Even if they said, they never said from the beginning that there's a problem with the mitzvah. They didn't observe a mitzvah, that's fine, but not that there's a problem. And he says that, Therefore, we're dealing with an issue here where the irreligious have the position that this whole halacha should be thrown out the window. And he says, this is a case of arkasat masana, that it's like the shoelace. When they tell you to change a shoelace, that's not, what's the halacha about a shoelace? It doesn't matter what shoelace. But since the non-Jews are making it into an issue, a Torah issue, therefore we have to stand up for it. And he says here too, it's not like if you could say, well, there's a different shita, we'll go by a toso so we can free them. No, because the whole idea here is that the secular government demands that this matter be solved. And then the Rebbe says something which I find strange. He says, and this is not about them getting married. He says, if they want to get married, they can go to Cyprus. He says, this is about basically uprooting the halacha. But that... they didn't want to get married. They did want to get married. I have to disagree with all due respect to the Rebbe. They could have gone to Cyprus, but first of all, they accepted, they weren't religious, but they accepted the idea of Jewish law in marriage. They wanted to get married in accordance with Jewish law. And they said, the children both said that we don't oppose Jewish law. They just wanted, and they wanted to get married. They didn't want to be outcasts. So what the Rebbe says here is really not correct. And then he says, this is not a private matter. That's why he's getting involved with it. This is a matter that affects the entire Torah. It's not a private matter just with the ach and the achot, because now this has become a matter dealing with the rabbinate. Will the rabbinate make rules for the government or not? And then he says, can you imagine a case, he says, where you, a balabas, can go to the rabbi and say to him, I will give you a rabbinic contract for a year or 5 years or even a lifetime contract if you promise me that you'll permit a certain thing. And the balabas says that, I don't know, I'm an amaretz, but I'm telling you what I want. And the Rebbe says, of course we wouldn't accept this. But I wonder, how many rabbis at their interviews are asked questions like, I know for a fact, she'll ask the rabbi, will you allow the women to carry the Torah on Simchas Torah? And depending on that answer, depending on whether they would hire him or not, and you can imagine some shuls, the shul I'm talking about, the answer was no, you couldn't let him. But you can imagine shuls that you'd have to say yes, and that would be the determining factor. Or would you support saying how on Yom HaSmut? You can imagine a lot of examples where the Baal Batim, who don't know halacha, they set the rules ahead of time, and the rabbi has to. I know someone who lost a rabbinic contract, or so he told me he lost it. As far as I know, there weren't any other issues, but I know the show. I can tell people the show privately. I won't say it here. Because he was asked, would he give an aliyah to someone who's intermarried? And he said he would. And one person in the show went crazy, and he thinks at least he lost it because of that. And the fact is that I told him afterwards that Lakewood Kollels all over the country give aliyahs to intermarried people, Chabad does. And then he called his Rebbe, Rav Shlomo Warman, who was on the RCA based in, and Rav Shlomo Warman told him what you said was correct. You know, in today's day and age, if someone comes to the show, we give him an aliyah. And yet so the idea that the Rebbe says that we don't ask the rabbi, we'll give you the contract unless, you know, because in theory, the Rav is supposed to decide and we're supposed to accept. We Baal HaBatim are not supposed to make these conditions. You know, what does the Baal HaBatim know about this matter of giving an aliyah to an intermarried person? And he, But that's what the Rebbe says. He says that that's inappropriate, and that was the case, he says, with Rav Gor. And he says a rabbi cannot accept pekudot shehu chayev lifsok ba'ofen kach. The rabbi can't take orders this way. He has to use his bikiyut and charifut to find in the Torah the sources for the psak. And then he goes on in the a longer discussion from Shabbos Chanukah of Teves, and he goes on that they're trying to get rid of the Torah here. First they abolish one thing, and then they're going to abolish more. And what do? They appoint a new chief rabbi who's going to take their orders afterwards. I mean, Rav Gorin says, he said this is not easy for him, but he has to remember this is someone who the Rebbe was close to, Rav Gorin. And he says, first they kick out the previous chief rabbi against what the Chasam Sofer says, and then they make it into something that we have to be mat'im the halacha, we have to find the proper halacha, so that doesn't work. He says they're destroying Torah, etc., etc. It's bribery. He goes into the whole thing of bribery. And then he says that Rav Gorin should announce right now that he made a whole mistake, now that he sees how he's being used, and he succumbed to this bribery. He wanted the position, and therefore he was willing to agree to come to a psak, which in his mind appears appropriate, but really it was because of the bribery that the government was willing to make him chief rabbi. So it's not an actual psak, even though he has the sources. He's looking at it through the lens of the position he's going to be given. Therefore, he should now, he said, bang on the table, and that he resigns and he has nothing to do with all this. And then he says Rav Gorin could have accomplished a lot had he remained chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Why is he putting himself into all this? And and he says Rav Gorin should announce that he regrets all this, even though he was appointed to this position on the condition that he would free the two Langer children. Rav Gorin denies that there was ever such a condition. And then the Rebbe says something interesting. He should know something, that the Nazir is Rav Gorin's father-in-law, who he was very close with. Here's a picture of the Nazir. And shortly before the Nazir's death, the Nazir writes to the Rebbe and says that they should remember him in Lubavitch. I guess it means they should pray for him because he was ill. And the Nazir also says that in important matters, you should listen to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Rebbe says, I never met with the Nazir. And he was not a Chabadnik, but we would have occasionally short letters. And you see that the Nazir says that you should follow basically what I'm saying. So then he says that everyone who holds from the Nazir, including Rabbi Gorin, you should do what the Nazir wants. And then the Rebbe said that it's not his way to speak this way. It's not his derech. We know that the Rebbe was not like this. And he doesn't mention names, but he had to, because it was so necessary, he had to adopt a different approach here. And look, I guess that's what makes a leader, that even though you're friendly with someone, if you feel that something is the truth, you have to speak your mind. So I guess that's what the Rebbe felt. And And we have to give kavod to Rav Gorin, who, despite the fact that the Rebbe really publicly attacked him, held him out to dry, all this, Rav Gorin didn't hold a grudge. And after the Rebbe passed away, Rav Gorin spoke about his greatness. There's two other things I want to show you. And that's, we saw this already before Rav Gorin was elected, a letter from signed by Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And here is afterwards, after the decision. And it says that we're shocked by what happened, that this ruling goes panim b'hara, you know, in an improper way. And therefore, what do we say? Hinenu machrizim, that we declare that the psakim of Rav Gorin are b'teilim, signed by Rabbi Abramsky, Rav Shmuelitz, Rav Moshe Chavroni, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Okay. Three of them we get. The Rav Chaim Shmuelitz is not known for being controversial, but okay, he's the Rosh Hashiva Haredi world. But Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, very strange, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. He's a moderate person with very close ties to the religious Zionist world. In fact, I can tell you now that the current Das Torah in the Haredi world, Rabbi Dov Landau, actually there's two of them, he's one of them, said that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is a kooknik. You know, he degraded him and, you know, didn't take him seriously, because then Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was a kooknik. He was part of Rav Kook's camp. And he's very close to religious Zionist, when I say part of the camp, that is in the great disputes that broke out. And when Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach referred to Harav, that's Rav Kook. Rav Kook was also in the Sadr Kiddushin. Same with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, by the way. But he had very close ties to the religious Zionist world. So why would Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach sign such a thing? In Halevi's dissertation, he quotes the grandson of one of the sons of Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, that Rav Shlomo Zalman's problem really was the signon, the tone of Rav Gorin, that he thought that he was creating a tone, especially the way he spoke to the secular newspapers, that halacha can solve all the problems, it's flexible, and we have another report that from this son of Rav Gorin, the son of Rav Shlomo Zalman, Rav Mordechai Auerbach, the same thing, that it really, the real issue with Rav Shlomo Zalman was the language he used and the impression he gave. Now it says that you can't accept his decisions, and yet Rav Yeshua ben Meir, who's a Rosh Yeshiva, one of the Hezri Yeshivas, he records that after the Yom Kippur War, which is only less than a year after the Psak, Rav Shlomo Zalman said that you can rely on Rav Gorin's Psakim on matters dealing with the army halacha. So it does seem that, and in fact, the son of Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, Rav Aaron Goldberg, told Halevi that until the end of Rav Shlomo Zalman's life, any time Rav Gorin's name was mentioned, Rav Shlomo Zalman praised all the great things he did in the army. So it seems that, so we see that Rav Shlomo Zalman did continue to respect Rav Gorin, and maybe he signed because he felt pressure, or maybe regarding that matter, he felt so strongly, but he clearly did not hold, as time went on, to this idea that Rav Gorin's psalkim are not to be relied on. Sometimes rabbis sign things that they don't agree with everything. I wrote a story blog post about this, precisely about Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. He signed something about conversions, that people who are not religious, the conversion is not valid, and yet I showed that in his own private writings previous to that, he says just the opposite. And one of his students said that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, for the sake of peace, would sign on to things that other rabbis wrote, even if he didn't agree with it. But he thought it was important to have a public stand, even though privately he felt differently. I think this is an example. And is that a weakness? Is that l'gnai, as we say? Or is that l'shvach? I'll leave it to you. Now, the last person, before we begin looking at Rav Gorin Sefer, is, of course, Rav Moshe. Posek of America. You know, in America, they say Gadol Ador. They don't say that in England, in Israel, because they have other great poskim, but certainly a very well-respected posek everywhere and the final authority in America. And he signs really for Agudas Rabbonim, and he got information, it says, from Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky, who Rabbi Moshe Feigstein had a great deal of respect for, going back already to Russia. They both were in the Soviet Union together. And that they declared, Rabbi Abramsky and the other Rosh Yeshiva, I just read it to you, those three, that all the psukim of Rav Goren or Batelim are invalid, and therefore the Agudas Rabbanim came together, and they expressed their agreement to what Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky said. So Agudas Rabbanim, Rav Moshe, they're signing on that Rav Goren's psukim are not valid. When this first happened, the first people who came out against Rav Goren, I read you what Rav Goren said about them. Who made you chief rabbis here? So I'll read it to you. It's Rav Goren says, this is from Halevi's, this is from Aviad Hollander's article at Chakira on Rav Goren. Rav Goren said, I never said that everyone should accept my opinion, but why didn't they invite me to speak to them and ask me, what's the basis of it? This is before he published his book. He says, I asked these Rosh Yeshiva, who are not practicing rabbis in any place, and they're not Dayani. How did they issue psak about me? Without hearing from me. Without seeing my documentation. And without even attempting to discuss it with me. Now, in his footnote here, Halevi cites testimony from the Stipler, where Rav Shach is reported to have said to the Stipler. The Stipler says that this is what Rav Shach told him, that Rav Shach heard Lashon Hara. What's the Lashon Hara? That the Admor of Gur, the Rebbe of Ger, said, have you seen? And remember, Rav Goren's family comes from the Ger Chassidim. So there'd be a connection here. The Ger Rebbe said, you're attacking him? You know, how are you attacking him so much? Have you seen his arguments? That's what the Ger Rebbe says. Maybe there's something there. So Rav Shach told the Stipler that he calls it Lashon Hara. But Rav Shach told the Stipler that's what the Ger Rebbe said. And the Stipler replied that doesn't matter. Ein bazek klum. There's nothing there. Why? Because if there was any svara to be matir, kvar Unterman haya matir, not Rabbi Unterman, but already Rav Unterman would have permitted it. So, or the other Bate Din would have permitted it. Okay, so, a couple more things, by the way, that I heard from Rabbi Aaron Felder, the following. Some of you might know Rabbi Aaron Felder. I've showed this picture. I'll show it again because it brings back good memories. It's already been over 10 years since he passed away. He was Talmud Muvak, just like Rabbi Ephraim Greenbelt was a Talmud Muvak of Ramosha, Aaron Felder was a Talmud Muvak of Ramosha in a different era, a decade or two decades later. And he's published, in addition to his own Chuvos, he published two volumes of things he heard from Ramosha and Halacha. And so I had the good fortune to be scholar in residence of his shul. And he was a raconteur. He was someone who loved to tell stories, and he's someone who knew all the different gedolim, including Rav Goren. He had entree because of his father. So all the stories I heard when I was with him that Shabbos, and then we did a Motzei Shabbos thing. The only time it ever happened, and at this time he could hardly see. He couldn't read, but people would read to him my Sfarim blog posts, and they'd read other things to him. He gave his drasha in the morning, with me sitting in the audience, was responding to one of my blog posts. But to the misfortune of his wife, I sat next to him at the Shabbos meals. You know, they had a Shabbos meal for the whole show. And I don't think it's Lashon Hara if I say that he never spoke to her. The whole time he's talking to me, I felt terrible. But he had all the stories he loved to tell, and I had all the stories that I loved to hear. And I just kept asking him questions. So finally, I got to the issue of Rav Goren and his relationship to Rav Goren, and listen to what he told me. He told me two things. I recorded after Shabbos, I recorded all the things he told me. He was the halachic authority for the Chaf Kei. All the halachic decisions in the Chaf Kei, he was, and he was also in Philadelphia, the posek. Shmuel Kamenetsky wasn't a posek of, let's say, Gittin matters, and it was him. He told me two things. One, he was a witness of. He says he was there with Rav Moshe and Rav Simcha Dolgin, rabbi in Los Angeles, the person in the RCA, minor Orthodox rabbi, was in New York, and he came to Rav Moshe's apartment, and he came in to talk to Rav Moshe, and then he asks him about the Langer case, and he wants to speak to him about, you know, Rav Moshe just came out against Rav Gorin. And Rav Moshe said very sternly, he says, "I'm sorry, Rabbi Dolgin, you have to leave now. I can't discuss this matter." And he basically kicked Rabbi Dolgin out, Rabbi Felder, who had been with Rav Moshe for so long. And other Rav Moshe, anyone could knock at his door. Anyone could call. His phone number was there. Anyone could call him. He never seen him this sort of response, which really you could see it as not polite. And Rav Moshe said that the problem was that if Rabbi Dolgin sat there with him for an hour explaining the whole issue, and then Rav Moshe explained why he can't accept Pesach, that whole thing, then the story would be spread that by Mizrahi circles, the modern Orthodox circles, that Rav Moshe sees it's a complicated issue, that he's not really that opposed, and in ours they would have spun it a certain way. Rav Moshe was worried about that, and therefore he said the only way to prevent them from spinning it is to simply say, "I'm not going to discuss it. We gave the Pesach, and you know, I can't discuss this." And that's the first thing he told me. And then the second thing he told me, and this is someone who knew Rabbi Gorin. By the way, it's also Rabbi Felder told me he's one of the only people who has smicha. He had smicha from Shlomo Yosef Zevin. Zevin basically didn't give smicha. So he knew all these rabbanim. He said that Rav Gorin's big problem was Rav Gorin felt that he was a general. He's an evil. He's a goon. You know, and he doesn't need to consult anyone. And he said that had Rav Gorin come to America and sat with Rav Moshe, you know, Rav Moshe, by the way, Rav Henkin supported Rav Gorin, as we'll see. And Rav Henkin and Rav Moshe were so close to one another. But Rav Henkin, we'll get to the end, Rav Henkin supported Rav Gorin. But if he said if he would have come to Rav Moshe and sat with Rav Moshe, Rav Moshe was matur things with a lot less to be matur than Rav Gorin in this case. He said if he would have sat with Rav Moshe, then who knows that it would have, it could have been an entirely, he could have convinced Rav Moshe maybe that he was right. But he's, the way Rav Felder put it, that this was a weakness of Rav Gorin that he didn't feel like he needed to explain. But the fact is, in this case, it was beyond him. And it was an international case. And he thought it was a strategic mistake by Rabbi Gorin that he should have at least tried to sit because Moshe would have sat with him. Rav Felder told me absolutely Rav Moshe would have sat with him and listened to him. And Rabbi Tendler told me something else because I gave a talk in Rabbi Tendler's shul. And Rabbi Tendler, of course, was there. Also, Rabbi Mordechai Tendler. And Rabbi Tendler said that, as far as he understands it, the reason Rav Moshe was so opposed to Rav Gorin in the Langer case is because he held you cannot have a Beis Din where the people do not reveal who they are, that their identities are secret. Dayanim need to stand behind their decision. And according to Rabbi Tendler, who said his words, these are his words, he says, Rav Gorin was an Adam Gadol. And he said that the problem Rav Moshe had with him is that he thought procedurally this is not the way to do it, that you can have secret Dayanim. And although that's not really in line with the document we saw, that all the psakim are thrown out. Okay, Abkan, until now, 6.5 classes, setting the context, leading up to it. But as you know, although the halacha is going to be very interesting, what makes this case such a crazy case is also the whole public relations, the politics, all that. So it was important to see this. We're going to go through the halachas, and then after that, I think it's a few weeks, we'll deal with the other dayanim, the secret dayanim, and we'll see what they say, and I will reveal at least 8 of the 9 dayanim, who they are, and then we will see who defended Rav Gorin. We saw who attacked him. We'll see who defended him, and some of you are going to be very surprised when you hear, I mentioned Rav Henkin. Wait till you hear about this Gon of Gonim who defended Rav Gorin. And some of you, I bet, knew him personally. But I'm just whetting your appetite here. Okay. So now I want to turn to this sefer. The Psak Din B'Inyan Ha'ach V'Ha'achot, As I said, you can get a copy if you want. It's like $50, but it's a rare book and it's not online. Although someone, you can get the whole text, but not the actual PDF of it. You can get it from Mizrahi. It's one of his 500,000 books. I mean, if you haven't seen Mizrahi's store, you got to go. So what is this book? Well, this book, it has the title of Psak Din Binyan Ha'ach Ve'Achot, the Psak Din in the case of the brother and the sister. That's how it's known. Written by Shlomo Goren, Rav Rashi Yisrael, V'Nasi Beit HaDin HaRabani HaGadol Yisrael, Chief Rabbi and President of the High Rabbinic Court. The Beit HaGadol is another name for the Beit HaGadol Yerurim, the Appeals Court. And it was published by, it says, Defus HaMemshala. That is, the Israeli government published it. And it comes out Tevet Tafshin Lama Gimel. So this is just like 5 weeks after, 4 weeks after the heter is given and they remarry. And it says, Shana Shishit L'Cheret Yerushalayim, sixth year from the liberation of Jerusalem, Chaf Hei Medina Israel. 25 years of the establishment of the state of Israel. There was a time when people would put that on the page in giving the date. They wouldn't just give the year, they would give the date from, the creation of the state of Israel. Okay. The book, we're going to go through the book. First of all, it has an introduction, and he begins by saying, on the 13th of Kislev, that's when the nine Dayanim signed on to his heter, and then it became a ruling and they married. And he begins talking about some of the history and the documentation. One of his big points, which he repeats again and again, is that this book is based on new information, which the previous Batei Din did not have. And for whatever reason, they chose not to revisit the case. Now, on right at the end of the preface, he has a nice little preface here before he gets into the nitty gritty. And he says that this, what you're reading here in the book, this this Psak Din, he says, I actually arranged this and set it out because Rabbi Nissim, like we know, Rabbi Nissim asked me to do this a couple of years before. And it's based on new information that was discovered after the final Beis Din, the Beis Din HaGadol Irurim, that's Rav Vadya, Rav Yoshev, and Rav Shaul Yisraeli. After they gave their ruling, I found new information that, and I said in the, I published this already, I suggested in that little booklet, and I said that this what I'm putting forth is not a psak, it's just information that the Dayanim could look at it again. And but we know what happened, that the Dayanim didn't look at it, or at least they didn't sit again as a Beis Din. But he feels, he said, based on that, there's room to change the psak. He says, and even subsequent to releasing that information, I have more information that makes it very clear to me that these children should be freed from the taint of Mamzerus. And then he says, we have to be upset, Yesh Litzair, that because of the difficult the situation in the air, that the Chugim Kanaim, that extremists have created, they threaten anyone who doesn't agree with their opinion. I have to keep the identities of the Dayanim secret. Nevertheless, he says, I will show you, and we'll see this, that this is in accord with Halacha and in opposition to what Rabbi Tenor at least told me Rav Moshe said. So let's, he begins with a letter, by the way, from the Langer children, beginning of Cheshvan, of Mar Cheshvan, of September, I guess, of October 1972, in which they ask Rabbi Goren to look at their case again, because they have no one else to turn to. Anu mitchanim b'fanecha, lavo l'ezratenu, letaher otanu, that to free us from this stain that has been put on us, lo edim k'sherim, without any proper witnesses or without any proofs or documentation at all. Remember, there's no documentation that you're going to argue. So Rav Gorin already spoke about how he knew the kids for years, and so there's a personal connection. He begins chapter one dealing with how the Batei Din examined this matter. And on page 14 already, he says that this is a case of Dinei Nefashos. Dinei Nefashos, we usually think of life and death. But Dinei Nefashos has a wider connotation. Someone who can't marry, that's Dinei Nefashos. What type of life it is if you don't have a chance to have a family, to get married. So he says it's psul mamzeres chamor kedinei nefashos. In other words, if you're asking me why I'm getting involved in this, why not just, you know, Dinei Nefashos already ruled on it? Because if you can save a life, you're not just going to say, well, someone else already ruled on it. If I can save their life, I'm allowed to, and I'm called upon to. And he cites a Yerushalmi that says it explicitly, that he says that all the halachic parameters of Dinei Nefashos also deal with, are found in the Psul Mishpacha. And this is very different than monetary cases where you can't just come out of the blue and re-litigate a case. And then he says, he quotes other Gemaras that he says that if you have knowledge, you have to be Lamed Schus, you have to help people in a case. He says, when dealing with a case like this, Ein Hitchashev Im Tfodos or Beit Din HaRishon, you don't concern yourself that if you find you uproot the ruling, that it's a disrespect to the previous Beit Din. He says, we're not concerned about this. And because it's Dinei Nefashot. Just like if a Beit Din ruled that someone is supposed to be executed, and you were able to find a new evidence that shows that a witness is lying or that they're innocent, are you going to say you're not going to present it because it's disrespect to the previous Beit Din, or because it's not the convention, you have to go follow the Batei Din? No, if you can save someone's life, it doesn't matter where you come from, you have the responsibility of creating a new Beit Din if necessary. And we're not concerned with any of these other procedural matters. And it's the same thing with a case of Mamzerus. And then he says in the next paragraph, this is very important, Beit Din Rashai Lismoch B'Shas Adchak Al Shitas Yachid Kedei Levatel Beit Din Rishon. A Beit Din, in dealing with a case like this, is allowed to rely, because it's a Shas Adchak, an emergency situation, on an individual opinion. Adas Yachid. Now you might say, well, we're going to see. The Rambam says one thing, and Rashi says, in other words, this is just one opinion in Tosfos. But you're allowed to. In a case of Mamzerus, you're allowed to rely on an individual opinion. This is Dinei Nefashos. We all know you can rely on an individual opinion if a rich person comes in with a chicken, it's problematic, so he can afford a new chicken, buy another chicken. But a poor woman, we know, it's Hefsei Meruba, so you can permit it in many cases. Same thing here. And then he says, he quotes Tosfos, once one rabbi rules something's permissible, he rules something's usher, forbidden, you can ask another person to permit it. As long as you let the other person know. That is, this Tosfos says this, if I give a psak, I give a psak a chumrah, the people I gave it to are allowed to ask another opinion. As long as they tell, but they have to tell the other person they're going to ask that they already asked my opinion. But if I give an opinion, I know we say you're supposed to accept the psak. But according to this Tosfos, if one rabbi gives a psak and it's a psak isur, you can ask another person, another posek, but you have to let them know. So this is a case where we're talking about it. Nothing's being hidden. The other Batei didn't know what's going on. So he sets out in the first chapter that what we are doing, the Beis Din I established, is in line with proper conventions. He cites, I'm just giving you the bottom line, but he's citing Bavli, Yerushalmi, Rishonim, that this is permissible. And then he says, what about the idea that once one rabbi issues a psak, that no one else, you know, his chavero can't come and contradict it. Like, you're a rav of a city, someone else can't come. And he says that he gives all reasons why it doesn't apply. It doesn't apply to great Talmidei Chachamim. And he gives other reasons why it doesn't apply. If the rav of a city, let's say, issues a psak, but then another rabbi has new information, he says it doesn't apply as well. So he gives all sorts of reasons here. And that's really the first chapter, all deals with the issues of how he ran his Beis Din. And then, of course, you get to the big problem, though. Who ever heard of a Beis Din where you don't know who the Dayanim are? Well, that's where we get to page 22, he gives you examples of, well, not examples, he gives you the summaries or the final rulings of all these nine Dayanim. Remember, Rav Gorin has his documentation, has his Aharon ruling. He gives it to these nine Dayanim. Now, we don't know how many Dayanim he asked. He could have asked 15, and only nine agreed with him. But he has nine Dayanim, that he refers to them as either Avot Batei Din, that is heads of Beis Din, or Dayanim, who are active right now in official Batei Din, and he has nine. And he gives the chavot dat, that's the opinions, the conclusions of these nine Dayanim, all of who say that we've examined this matter based on this new information, the Rav Gorin, and then we conclude that these children are not mamzerim. In one of them, Dayan number eight, actually, he goes into. In his conclusion, or he, not his conclusion, it's I think the others maybe just gave a short paragraph. He has a longer conclusion or a longer chavodat, and he says it's interesting because this is like a summary. He says, I was asked to look at this case of a convert who claims that he converted and he has no witnesses. He says he converted 43 years ago in Warsaw and he married a Jewish girl. And this rabbi, the rabbi of the town of Lokov, performed the wedding, and he has no witnesses to this. He claims that he was tovel in a mikvah, and he doesn't remember whether he went in the mikvah before or after the bris milah. He says that from the day he converted, he always was shomer Shabbos and went to shul and davened and put tefillin on every day. And when the Beis Din asked him, do you put the tefillin of Rosh, the head tefillin, on before the arm tefillin? He didn't know the answer. And he couldn't complete the sentence, Shema Yisrael. He didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't know the words, he's supposed to go to shul every Shabbos. He didn't know the words of L'cha Dodi. And not only that, He married his wife before he claims that he had kiddushin with her. He married her in a church. What we're going to see is that there's going to be divergence in the actual facts of the case. So if you accept one set of facts, you'll come to one conclusion. If you accept a different set of facts, you'll come to a different conclusion. And then the upshot of these facts, which we're going to see next class. I mean, if someone converts to Judaism and then continues going to a church and baptizes his child and does all these things, is this still a valid conversion? So we're going to get into this big issue of can you void a conversion or not? But I see that we're already, I wonder though. Well, he has the name Avraham Barakovsky. Where did he get the name Avraham? Did he just make it up or did he just... I mean, he couldn't say he was circumcised. That's proof of something, because no one in Europe is circumcised. No one in Poland, if you're not Jewish. He couldn't say who converted him. But and even if he came up with a name, you couldn't confirm it. But I mean, that's going to have some sort of circumstantial evidence that he is circumcised. And he has the name Avraham. I mean, I guess, okay, he could have just taken the name Avraham when he got to Israel or something. But the fact that he's circumcised is a big deal. But you know, wait till you see what Chava's father had to say about this guy basically taking his daughter. So maybe he just was circumcised because he was forced to. So we're going to get into all the, the contradictory testimony, whether he were married by a rabbi, whether he would attend church. The funny thing is that even though this Barakovsky does nothing, the Haredim brought him out and had a big rally in which they put him up there, and he declared, "I am a Jew." all of a sudden they put him up there. But okay, so we will. We're just starting on the halachic matters, and so let me take the questions and comments. Charlie, if you're a professor at Albert Einstein, I know technically it's not really a YU institution, although YU still has, I think, 49% of it. But if you told me that you had issues of anti-Semitism at Albert Einstein, that would be a major problem. Well, let me tell you what. Someone privately says that Rabbi Steinberg was close to his father, and so I had never heard of actually Rabbi Steinberg. I looked him up after Rabbi Finkelman told me that. Rabbi Yellen, in your personal experience, it's not uncommon for the board to ask rabbinic candidate the kinds of questions you are mentioning. It's never stated the offer of the position is conditional on the right answer, but it's often so understood. Yeah, well, they would never say it's conditional, but we all know that you have to give the right answer because unless the board is absolutely split between different opinions on it, usually the reason they're asking it, like you can imagine a shul, and I don't think there's a problem with this. If something's halachically permissible, like we're coming up to Purim, in my humble opinion, and those of you who listen to me know that I'm not into these Shira Hadasha things, I'm not into women reading Torah, I'm not into any of that stuff, even with the arguments that are made, women's minion or quasi-egalitarian. But I feel that there's no problem with a woman's Megillah reading. And it's not, I mean, real poskim from the mainstream religious Zionist world, not, liberal types. I think Rav Avraham Shapiro even said that. And especially today, when there's so many issues today with the feminists, and the difficulties we're having, if we can allow them to have it, I don't see a problem at all with this. And it's absolutely mutter, al pi halacha, for a women's group to get together, the same level of obligation to read Megillah. Now, it's true. Some rabbis might say, in the past, women have done it. They might say this will lead to feminist innovations, whatever. Okay, so I don't see a problem, although it seems the Rebbe would have an issue with this. I wouldn't see a problem with a shul that they know their clientele, that this is important, to ask a rabbi, would you permit a women's Megillah reading? And if the rabbi said no, that because this is not really halacha, this is sort of like a hashkafa thing, and you can definitely pick a rabbi based on hashkafa. Now, carrying the Sefer Torah and simplest Torah, the rabbi, you might say it's hashkafa, and the rabbi might say it's halacha, so there could be a little dispute there. But on a matter like the Megillah reading, I think it's completely appropriate, just like you can ask the rabbi, would you be comfortable, would you accept if our shul says halal on Yom Ha'atzma'ut? Again, that's halacha also, perhaps, but it's mixed with hashkafa, or all sorts of matters. Look, the rabbi has to be a good fit. And but the Rebbe says that this is unheard of, that you're going to ask a rabbi halachically what your decision is. We know that when they go before the Congress, the Senate, the Supreme Court, they're always asked the questions, and then they say, this might come up before me, so I can't comment. Now, we're dealing with a super right-wing judge, and he's asked a question about abortion. I might have to deal with it, so is the rabbi supposed to say that, I can't answer because it might come up and it could be complicated, but it does seem that Rabbi Yell, and that's my experience also.
It's also for the advantage of the rabbi. I mean, if you know that this is something important to you and the shul absolutely doesn't want it, you might say to yourself, unlike a Supreme Court justice who has a life appointment and has all the benefits of it, this is not a place I want to be. I'm not looking to start a relationship that's going to be constantly, we're going to be at war with each other. So I think it's for the benefit of the rabbi as well.
I do too. Of course, Rabbi the Lubavitch Rebbe, he might even agree with that, but for a local rabbi, but for the country to have such a decision, although you could say you want a rabbi who reflects the country. You're not getting a rabbi from Meir Shearim. But that's not how the Rebbe formulated. He says that you don't ask the Shiloh make it a Tanai, that this is, but okay. Yes, and USRI Temler, it was Rabbi Moshe Temler who told me that his father-in-law's big issue was he thought that this idea of just having a secret based in that's not being authentic. If you're a Dayan, and Rav Avram Shapiro, I'll say it now, I'll come back to it. He was asked, are you one of the Dayanim? And he said, no, I'm not one of the Dayanim. He said, by the way, that Rav Gorin's tshuva is very solid. He said, are you one of the secret Dayanim? He said, no, how could I be one of these Dayanim? The Torah says, Osaguru. If I was a Dayan, I'd sign my name to it. But we're going to see, next class will begin with Rav Gorin's proofs. And these are not from crazy faraway places. These are like mainstream sources that Dayanim don't have to make their names public. And and then we're going to go through all of Rav Gorin's major points to get to his heter. So with that, yes, Nissan, that he was the son-in-law and very close, of course, to Rav Moshe, and the medical tshuvot in particular. I know people like to say, well, medical tshuvot, is it really Rav Moshe or is it Rav Tendler? I never understood this argument, because at the end of the day, Rav Moshe didn't know the medicine, but he trusted Rabbi Tendler. Just like a posek doesn't know about electricity, he brings someone in to explain to him how it works. Rav Moshe trusted Rabbi Tendler in this matter absolutely, and therefore Rabbi Tendler explained it out. And you might say, well, Rabbi Tendler explained it a certain way, brain death, so therefore he sort of was controlling the decision. Look, Rav Tendler explained it the way he understood it, and Rav Moshe accepted Rav Tendler's understanding. And I'll just mention, by the way, when it gets to brain death, everyone always blames it on Rav Tendler. Go to the Halachic Organ Donor Society website. You see a video there from Rav David Feinstein. And Rav David Feinstein says he doesn't want to use the word brain death or anything. He says, I'll just tell you what my father told us, that when someone isn't breathing, then he's dead. And if you're brain dead, you're not breathing. That's they said they would hold a feather up in Europe. They didn't look for, the heartbeat or anything. They just put the feather to the nose. And if there's nothing coming out, then that's death. And if you're brain dead, you don't breathe on your own. So it's not just, Rabbi Tendler. He was obviously very strong on this matter. But enough said about that. Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you. Just had to clear my audio. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, tomorrow Rabbi Shulman is not giving his regular class. He's unavailable, but Rabbi Mintz will be giving his class at tomorrow is Tuesday, yeah. So Rabbi Mintz giving his class and at 11 a.m., and then he's extending his series 1 week. It's supposed to end tomorrow, just like Tamar Weisman today is extending her class by 1 week. So next Monday and Tuesday, and next Monday, Yosef Lindell is starting a five-part series on issues in the Haggadah, and then please God, Sunday, March 30th, we're going to do a Yom HaYun on the Haggadah, go through the Haggadah. We did a similar thing last year, and then we'll have a whole bunch of Shirim. But in the meantime, we'll have all our regular Shirim this week and upcoming week, and I think that's it. Nothing to argue with you, Dr. Mark, this week, or whatever. But by the way, I do want to clarify last week, in case people misunderstood, I believe Halo made me call Adam. That we can learn from everybody, even people who I make sure, we were talking about rabbis who have sort of moral or extreme positions that are per border on the Chilul Hashem. You can still learn from them. My own argument is that I don't consider them a rab in terms of a posik or a leader. And the same way I'm happy to learn from a reform rabbi and a Haredi rabbi and anything. But in terms of who I'm going to look up to as a rabbi, it's got to be a particular thing. And it is true. When Rav Avadi Yosef had these extreme statements, it lowered my sort of, yes, he's tremendous. You can learn his Torah, but I do think it affects how you view him as a rabbi. But anyway, I don't pick on last week's argument, but I did want to clarify that. I don't know if you want to comment.
I agree 100%. Thank you for that clarification.
I'm sorry, but anyways. Okay, everybody.
What did you say about Rabbi Shulman?
Rabbi Shulman's class is not tomorrow. He's at actually a conference, so he can't give his class tomorrow. We will send out an email. I think he announced it last week. So he'll continue next week. He's just not giving his class tomorrow. So tomorrow, our only class will be Rabbi Adam Mintz. He's be talking about conversion of children, which Rav Moshe has a lot to say about. And I believe that's his class this upcoming week. And okay. And we look forward to learning with you. Please invite a friend to come and enjoy your evening in Scranton, Dr. Shapiro.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll look forward to seeing everybody next week and in between, too. All right, Lila Tov, everybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Be well.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay.